Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. I'm your host, Cara Santa Maria. This week, I talk nerdy with ecologist Chad Hansen. It's a fascinating chat, and we will get to it very shortly. There's only a little bit of business to attend to here at the top of the show. I want to thank those of you who have supported Talk Nerdy and made it possible for each and every one of you to download it absolutely free of charge week after week. I want to first, through the PayPal portal, which is a place where you can make one-time or monthly donations, I want to thank Steve, I think it's Bergier. Maybe probably Steve Bergier. I'm going to go with that. From Coto de Casa, California. Thank you so much, Steve, for your incredibly generous support. And also over at the Patreon portal. So that's at patreon.com/talknerdy. This is a place where you can support on an episodic basis. I want to thank Phil T-Bear, Timothy Glover, Ken Pfeiffer, Brian Holden, Jeffrey Sewell, and all of the rest of you. Thank you so much for your support. Week after week, I could not do it without you. All right, guys, without further ado, why don't we just jump right in? Like I said, I'm very pleased to introduce Dr. Chad Hansen. He is an ecologist with the John Muir Project, and we are going to talk nerdy about forest fires. Here he is, Chad Hansen. Thank you so much for joining me in my humble, as I always say, apartment studio.
My pleasure. Thanks.
So you came to LA. You don't actually live in LA, do you? Do you live in Big Bear?
Big Bear area, about 8 miles east of town, way eastern end of the mountain range.
Nice. What a beautiful place to live.
It is. It's very nice. We live up about 7,000 feet in elevation in the pinyon pine forest.
So is your choice of accommodations directly tied to your profession as an ecologist?
It is. It's nice to live in the mountains. I do have some study sites, some research sites that are very close by in that mountain range. But also it's just a preference. I like being in the mountains.
I like that. So you are an ecologist, an academic ecologist, and you work for or with or above, I don't even know how you would put it, with the John Muir Foundation.
John Muir Project, yes.
John Muir Project. Yeah. So see, I already screwed up this early in the podcast. With the John Muir Project, will you tell me what the John Muir Project is?
Sure. We're a small nonprofit forest conservation and research organization, and we're under the umbrella of Earth Island Institute, which is based in Berkeley.
And what made you, because you were a founding member of the John Muir Project?
Yes.
What prompted you to want to organize it?
Well, it's a longer story, but mm-hmm. the shorter version is that toward the end of college, when I was an undergraduate, I took a year off. I hiked the Pacific Crest Trail mm-hmm. from Mexico to Canada with my older brother, and saw all the clear-cutting going on national forest lands, these massive areas that were completely deforested.
And that's for hardwoods or for paper or for...
Mostly for lumber, but some of it was being turned into paper too. So, you know, we're talking about ponderosa pine and mixed conifer forests and Douglas fir forests and completely clear-cut. And so I wanted to get involved in forest conservation after that, and ultimately got... involved in enough that I felt like I should start my own organization. So then I founded JMP.
Nice. So you kind of felt like you could do more in that capacity than continuing maybe as a research scientist for a large academic institution.
Well, actually, I didn't start off as a scientist. When I first got involved in forest conservation work, I was doing it mostly as an activist and then ultimately went back to law school. I got my law degree, and my intention was to really enforce federal environmental laws. About 3 weeks before I graduated in 1995, Congress passed what they called at the time the salvage logging rider, basically an appropriations rider that suspended all the laws on national forest lands. And that was my specialty. So it basically closed the courthouse doors to the work that I was already starting to do for a period of at least 2 years.
Why? They suspended all legislation related to...
That's right. All laws. Every single law. So there was
literally... And that was just in one sweeping bill that passed?
Yeah, it wasn't even a bill. It was an appropriations rider. They just inserted it into a large appropriations bill at the end of the session. Kind of that classic cover of darkness worst possible scenario for legislation, the way it's absolutely not supposed to happen. But the timber industry flexed its muscle. They wanted it. They got it.
Yeah.
And that was the political reality at the time. They could do that. And that threat rears its ugly head periodically. It's doing it right now, in fact, once again. And so it really got me thinking more and more about the policy aspects of things. And the policy aspects ultimately led me back to science, because what I found is that by the mid-1990s, the jobs versus environment argument was getting very, very old.
Mm-hmm.
Gone were the days when the timber industry would just say, well, the timber's out there, we want it, we're going to go grab it, we make money, who cares? After a while, the Forest Service and the timber industry began to package their logging program in benign or benevolent sounding arguments. We need to do this logging for forest health. We need to do it for ecological restoration. We need to do it to mitigate fire hazard or spread. And so everything began to take on this more ecological aspect to it in terms of the way it was presented.
But it was really pseudoscientific.
I was seeing the same thing on the ground. So you'd see these same old clear cuts or these same hacked up forests. Oftentimes they were called thinning projects, and it sounds really benign again. You'd go in and 80, 90% of the trees are removed, including old growth trees. And so I began to think more and more about the science and start investigating the questions and the justifications that were being used to drive the logging program.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what led me back to graduate school in ecology.
So you did your undergrad, then you went to law school. Then you realize that almost all of the court cases that you could be involved in were no longer had legislative backing. And then you decided to go back to grad school. So now you are a PhD JD?
Yes.
Interesting. Do you still do work in the legal side of things?
No, I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a practicing attorney.
Mm-hmm.
But I definitely advise attorneys. My wife is an attorney, and she files lawsuits to enforce environmental laws on national forest lands. And I work with other attorneys, with Center for Biological Diversity and other groups. But mostly I'm working as a scientist. I'm writing expert declarations to inform the court about a technical issue on ecology.
But that's so good to hear, that as somebody who is doing active science but also informing the courts, that you have that background knowledge in what the courts, you know, need or are interested in. Because I think a lot of times what I've noticed in interviewing many, many scientists through the years is that there's a bit of a break between sort of the scientific community and the legislative or the public policy community, that there's almost this idea that somehow science is cleaner if you do it without thinking about the policy ramifications, that somehow you can be less influenced in that way. But as we know, science is predominantly funded by the federal government, and they really are, I think, in many ways, inextricably linked. And so to at least be knowledgeable about the policy surrounding the science that you do, even if you're not an activist or, you know, a lawyer in your case, even just to be knowledgeable about it seems like the least naive approach.
Yeah, you have to know what's going on in the political realm. You really do. If you want science to matter, mm-hmm. You have to be savvy about policy. Because otherwise, you're doing these scientific studies and you're getting them published. And it's a lot of work. It's a tremendous amount of work, every single study. And if you're advancing scientific knowledge and you think that's great, you know, we just answered this really important question, who cares if no one knows about it? Or if they do know about it, but it's politically inconvenient and it's going to cost someone some money, and so they want to ignore it. You have to make it matter on the ground where it counts. Otherwise, it's like it never happened.
And this is something that you have actually been specifically focusing on here in the past, would you say, month or so? Or has it been longer than that, actually trying to have those boots on the ground to talk to Congress and to get out there and talk to media outlets to communicate the science of an issue that's happening right now? Is that correct?
That is, yeah. And I've always done a certain amount of this, but I've definitely done more in the past few months. Right now, there's a particular legislative threat in both the House and the Senate. The House passed a bill, a logging bill, that would suspend environmental laws once again to massively increase commercial logging on our national forests. You know, again, using the fear and misunderstanding about fire in our forests in order to justify suspending laws and basically turning over most of our federal public lands to the timber industry.
So prior to this kind of threat that's occurring right now, you had mentioned in the 90s that there was that appropriations bill. Then I'm assuming that certain legislators fought to kind of reinstate protections.
At that time, the appropriations rider that they inserted into the bill, the appropriations bill in 1995, had a 18-month shelf life.
Oh, I see.
But it also said that any logging projects that were basically prepared during that time period were covered and therefore were not subject to any federal environmental law indefinitely. So we had a situation where there was just this rush on the part of the Forest Service and the other federal land management agencies working with the timber industry to get all these logging projects packaged up and put into the pipeline, so to speak. And so as long as they had that decision before that 18-month period passed, they were covered indefinitely. So this happened. This basically was effectively a suspension of all laws, total lawless logging for 3 or 4 years on national forest lands.
Jeez, because then all of these new projects that crop up, which these lobbyists have obviously been working towards getting this legislation or this appropriations rider passed, they've been planning, right? So then during this 18-month period, the idea is anything that happens then is grandfathered in for the lifetime of the project.
That's right. Anything goes. As long as it's got a decision signed during the active period of that legislation, it was covered basically forever. So
I would assume that even now some of those projects are ongoing.
I don't know. It's an interesting question. I know that there was certainly a trail off period.
Yeah, for sure.
And so after 3 years, there weren't that many, three or 4 years, but you know, there were some still out there 6, 7+ years after. After a while, there weren't as many, and so people stopped paying attention. But, you know, it was a very real threat, and that's what we're facing right now once again.
Because now this is 20-plus years later,
and it's
kind of history repeating itself.
It's exactly what's going on. In fact, not only is it history repeating itself in terms of what's being proposed by the House and Senate Republicans, but the threat is almost exactly the same, because the talk is that they could try to attach it to the Interior Appropriations Bill in December, which is exactly what happened in 1995.
Yeah. And so this is specifically something that you're seeing is lateralized with the political parties. You know, there's some, I think, environmental issues that seem to know no party, like big oil, for example, seems to be a pretty effective lobby and can, in many cases, get what it wants, both from the Republicans and from the Democrats. But there are some partisan politics at play when we come to environmental issues, as we know. I think the Democratic side has long had a little bit of a better environmental record. Not always. I mean, don't get me wrong. I think in many cases, both the Democrats and the Republicans are two sides of a very similar coin. But in this case specifically, you're seeing that it's House and Senate Republicans that are pushing this legislation?
It is. They're overwhelmingly led by Republicans. But having said that, there are a small number of Democrats that have joined them on this. And this is the threat, because there is so much misunderstanding and so much fear about fire. And there's so many myths that are persistent that a lot of the timber industry's supporters in Congress are taking advantage of that. And some well-meaning but poorly informed Democrats have been pulled along with that. And now the timber industry and the Republicans are courting some of the others. For example, they're courting Senator Dianne Feinstein and trying to get her to support at least some version, maybe a compromised version of these logging bills, which is really what they wanted all along, was some kind of compromised version that would have at least some nominal Democrat support.
So that is one thing that I'll say, that historically the Republicans have been much better than the Democrats at is asking for everything, because they know eventually they'll get some of it. Whereas Democrats are historically pretty bad about going in negotiating.
Yeah.
Like, no, you go in with all your cards on the table. And so in this case, let's kind of compare. I mean, you had mentioned that in the 90s when a very similar thing passed, and of course now we're at a stage where this has not passed, where you are actively fighting to ensure that it does not get passed. You were saying that there was this usage of kind of ecological sort of pseudoscientific veil around it. oh, it's better for the habitat. It's better for, you know, to thin out the forest. But now specifically, it's a very similar situation, but they're talking about fire.
That's right. And they were talking about fire in 1995 too. Yeah. And this is, you know, like you said, history repeating itself in a very real way.
And so yeah. I want to talk about fire. Yeah. You know what I mean? I want to talk about this. You know, I think that a lot of citizens and probably some of these politicians, like you said, some of them are sort of in bed with these lobbyists, and they know exactly what's going on. And some of them are just misinformed, because we do think about global climate change. We think about warming temperatures. We think about drier forests, and we see the news coverage. Forest fires on the rise. Right. You know, the Hollywood Hills are burning. The hillside is burning. People are losing their homes. And there is kind of, I think, a general public opinion that forest fires are bad, forest fires are man-made, and forest fires can never be healthy for the ecology of the forest itself. But that's not necessarily true, is it?
No, it's not. In fact, quite the opposite is true. It's what makes it such an interesting issue, because so many of the lessons in forest and fire ecology are counterintuitive. So, for example, we now know that fire is a very natural thing in forest ecosystems. Not only is it natural, but the ecosystem depends on it. The biodiversity, fire is basically like forest, like rain and sunlight to forests. They need it. There are many plant and animal species that have evolved to depend upon unique habitat characteristics that can only be created by fire. And fire cycles nutrients and keeps the forest productive, which in turn helps the forest sequester carbon from the atmosphere and turn it into the growing vegetation in the forest. And so it's a vital process. And in fact, one of the interesting things that we've learned, and a lot of the research has come out in the last 10 or 15 years, so we've had this enormous surge in the last decade of scientific knowledge. And one of the things we've learned is that the areas that burn hottest, mm-hmm. where fire kills most or all the trees, and it's a minority of the fire effects. You know, most of these fires, including the biggest ones, they're mostly low and moderate intensity. Most of the trees survive, but you get some trees that die. But there are pockets where it burns hotter, mm-hmm. it's called high-intensity fire. And that creates a habitat that we call snag forest habitat. And the more technical term is complex early seral forest. But snag forest is basically all these standing fire-killed trees. And when they fall down, the down logs and these native shrubs that regenerate after fire and all the natural trees of conifers and the oaks that regenerate after fire, all that new forest growth, mm-hmm. that's snag forest habitat. And contrary to being destroyed, it turns out that that habitat is as biodiverse as old growth forest.
Interesting.
And it has comparable levels of wildlife abundance, and usually higher levels of wildlife abundance than old growth forest, which is the second highest in most data sets out there.
And is that because animals that were living there can come back in more numbers, or are there whole new organisms that live there that couldn't live in a mature forest?
That's exactly right. It's there. Everything you find in a mature forest is also found in snag forest habitat. Mm-hmm. Not everything that's found in snag forest habitat is found in mature forest.
So there are potentially organisms that needed more of that sunlight, or they needed more of that nitrogen or carbon-rich soil from the ash from the trees, that there's something that's happening there that's kind of inviting new organisms in.
Exactly, yeah. So let me give you an example. One of the species that is most closely associated with snag forest habitat really depends on it. It's called the black-backed woodpecker. And this woodpecker basically needs enormous densities of fire-killed trees, recently fire-killed trees, in order to survive, because when the fire comes through and it kills trees in a patch, that attracts these native beetles called wood-boring beetles. And they've evolved receptors in their bodies to detect the heat or the smoke from fires from dozens of miles away. So they make a beeline for the fires. They lay their eggs on the bark of a fire-killed tree, and the larvae develop, and they bore into the tree underneath the wood, underneath the bark, and that's where they develop. And that's what the woodpeckers have evolved to depend upon for their food, is the larvae from those wood-boring beetles.
So there's this chain that happens. And I'm sure that there's like microorganisms that come along with those as well. I think I've read something about this, how in California recently we've been seeing infestations of these wood-boring beetles because there's not enough fire, I guess, source forest for them.
Yeah, we've had an increased activity of bark beetles in particular, but also wood-boring beetles this year. And you tend to see that in drought conditions. You get these cycles and you'll get higher activity during drought conditions than when you get
bark
fires.
Beetles especially.
Yeah, and what people don't oftentimes don't realize is that these are native species. They evolved in these forests. They're always in the forest at different levels. And in order to have healthy populations of them, you have to have these pulses periodically of drought and of fire. And it's funny because people think of them the way they think of, you know, some sort of a pest, and you hear that kind of conversation, that kind of terminology. But in reality, the larvae from these native beetles are the cornerstone of the ecosystem in so many ways, because that's the food for the woodpeckers. Without those, the woodpeckers don't exist. And you need the dead trees for the beetles to exist. You have to have the dead trees for the woodpeckers, because that's where they excavate their nest cavities, because the wood's a little softer than live trees. And they excavate a new nest cavity every single year, these woodpecker species, blackback woodpeckers, hairy woodpeckers, white-headed woodpeckers. And so when they're done, that means they're available for bluebirds, for wrens, for nuthatches, even squirrels, even flying squirrels, pine martens, all these other species, birds and mammals, to use those nest cavities, because they can't create their own. So without the dead trees, no beetles, without the beetles, no woodpeckers, without the woodpeckers, no bluebirds, no nuthatches, etc.
So as the forest, I shouldn't say dies, but as the trees die from the burning and then new life starts to develop in the forest, you have this whole new kind of story that occurs again.
Exactly.
And eventually, once it's too mature, it has to happen all over again to be able to invite those, I guess, higher on the food chain organisms back into the forest.
That's exactly right. And the whole point is that you want this mix at any given point in time across the forested landscape. You want unburned forests that have significant numbers of dead trees just from competition and drought stress and bark beetles. And you want areas that are burned, low, moderate intensity, and patches of high intensity fire, some large, some small. You want that whole mix because that's what maintains the full range of native biodiversity in the forest. Then everyone's getting what they need. The problem right now is that, contrary to what you see all too often in the headlines, we have far less fire in our forests now than we had historically.
Interesting. So we just have more news coverage.
We have a lot more news coverage, but we have far less fire. And this is just, everyone agrees upon this. So this is a consensus scientific opinion. We're still debating all kinds of more nuanced issues, like how much less fire do we have? We know we have less fire. We know we have less fire of all intensities, including high intensity fire. But the big debate right now is, well, you know, do we have half as much? Do we have one fifth as much, et cetera? But that's where it's at. But I think that the average person, you know, watching television, reading the newspaper, would not realize that. They would think we have this enormous overabundance of fire in our forests.
Especially living where I live, for example, here in Hollywood, and we just bought a home in the hills in Los Feliz, and it's the funniest thing because people come see the new house, or I'll tell them we're moving to. It's almost the first thing anybody says, oh, lots of fires up there. Yeah.
It's true.
I mean, there are, you know, you do see the signs. Anytime you're in the hills in the Los Angeles area, you do see the signs that say, you know, fire warning, don't throw a cigarette butt out the window, things like that, which is fair. It's a dry area. We don't want to cause forest fires. We remember Smokey the Bear. And obviously, I think it's probably safe to say that that is not something you are advocating as a scientist.
No, of course. You know, lightning causes fires and has for many, many, you know, millions of years in North America and around the world in fire-adapted ecosystems. And so lightning causes plenty of fires. That's not the problem. The problem is that 98% of the lightning-caused fires are put out by the U.S. Forest Service at enormous cost to taxpayers every single year, even in the most remote backcountry areas, before they can reach more than just a few dozen or a couple hundred acres in size.
Why is that? Is it just because as human beings, we kind of check our, I don't know, our cognitive reactions at the door, and we have this gut check emotional truthiness that says fire bad, must contain?
I think that's part of it. I think there's an inertia of past, you know, kind of fear and prejudice of fire that still continues to this day that we really need to get past. I think part of it's hubris. You know, fire is bad and we can control it. We are human. We can dominate and get rid of it. And that's dominated fire suppression and fire management for over a century. And it's not true. It's never been true. Fires are driven by weather. Yeah. Once they get going and reach a certain size, it's not really about the forest density or the structure. It's about hot, dry, windy conditions and topography. And it doesn't matter if you've 2,000 firefighters trying to stop that fire, the fire is going to do what it's going to do. And then when the weather changes, the fire slows down or stops and everyone says, oh, we suppressed the fire.
Because in essence, the job of a firefighter, which is an incredibly noble profession, oftentimes a volunteer profession, is to protect health and human safety and human property. So the idea is, I'm a firefighter, my neighbor's house is on fire, I need to put that fire out to make sure that nobody is injured and to make sure that their, you know, their property isn't damaged. So we especially get concerned about forest fires if we're afraid that they're encroaching on, you know, areas where people are living.
And this is such an important point. You know, in the past, and still to this day, the majority of fire suppression funding and staffing and activities basically focused on suppressing backcountry fires that are nowhere near homes.
Interesting.
And that's very damaging ecologically, especially when we have a deficit of fire in these forests and the species that need post-fire habitat, like the black-backed woodpecker. Even like the spotted owl for foraging habitat, it needs a post-fire habitat because that's where the small mammal prey base is the best. Those species are in trouble, a lot of them. A lot of them are declining because they don't have enough habitat. And what is created oftentimes is then clear-cut by the U.S. Forest Service, which devalues this as an ecosystem and sees it only as timber. Mm-hmm. And they keep the revenue from that, so it's a business to them. Creates a very powerful, perverse incentive. And so it kind of keeps the system going. It keeps people thinking over the ridge, out there somewhere. That's the problem. That's what we need to focus on. And meanwhile, homes are left unprotected oftentimes. Now, we're seeing a shift there, and that's really important because firefighters are putting themselves at risk, and they're going to enormous lengths and putting themselves at risk to try to do their jobs. Now, where we need to focus that is protecting homes and structures. We need to protect communities, and that's an incredibly important value unto itself. But still, so much of the activity, most of it, is out there in the backcountry because we're still seeing a policy that's driven by assumptions of the past, assumptions that are now completely scientifically debunked, that basically assume that it's worth it to risk the lives of firefighters. It's worth it to spend $4 billion of taxpayer money every year fighting these backcountry forest fires because we have to, because it's destroying the forest. That's what people thought.
Yeah, and I mean, it's one of those misconceptions that it's like you get why people think it. You know what I mean? Yeah. I had no idea that most of the active firefighting energy and money is going into fighting fires that aren't anywhere near homes.
Yeah, that's the fact. Now, in any given year, that can vary. You might have a couple of fires that are really significant fires that are very close to homes and communities. Mm-hmm. You know, we saw that with two fires this year, the Butte Fire and the Valley Fire, both basically in areas that are not in national forests. They're lower down in elevation, and mostly it's grassland and chaparral and some woodland. But there's a lot of homes in there, and a lot of homes were lost.
Sure.
There. So I think that we're seeing a shift, and I think that we can encourage that shift to go to accelerate so that we focus more and more on protecting homes and on informing people how to protect their own homes before the fires happen, instead of focusing on the backcountry and let those backcountry fires burn, because we're not effectively suppressing them anyway once they get going. And that's when most of the money is spent trying to suppress them, is after it's not possible to suppress them.
So it's like a double whammy. We're wasting resources and we're also actually decreasing the health of the forest.
That's absolutely right. And we're actually putting people unnecessarily at risk, not just firefighters, but homeowners, because they've been given a false sense of security. You know, look, we're stopping these fires out there in the backcountry. You're protected. Or we're doing this thinning project out there 2 miles from your homes, and somehow on this ridge 2 miles away, that's going to stop the fire. It doesn't work that way. We know now scientifically that the only effective way to protect homes is to focus on defensible, what we call defensible space within 100 feet of the home itself, basically reducing combustible shrubs and limbing up the larger trees and cutting out the smaller trees and basically reducing vegetation.
Gotcha.
Doesn't mean you remove everything. You don't want to do that, but you want to basically make it more fireproof.
You clean up the kindling around
exactly. Your house. Exactly, the smaller stuff. That's what burns most readily, is the small diameter material, the branches and the small trees. And then focus on the home itself. Fire-resistant siding, fire-resistant roofing. Simple things like rain gutter guards. People don't think about this, but you know, you go through all these forested areas in the rural West, and you see people with rain gutters with 6 inches of dry pine needles piled up in those rain gutters. Well, those fires go, and you've got these flaming embers that are blown by the winds a quarter of a mile, sometimes half a mile in advance of the fire, lands on the roof, rolls down into that pile of dry needles, and burns the house down. Simple things like that. You know, you see people with 6 feet of old newspapers stacked against an exterior wall. Well, that house is going to burn.
Yeah, that's exactly how you start a fire in your fireplace. Right. You need something that catches really readily so that you can get the wood to burn.
Exactly. But as long as the conversation is about, you know, out there somewhere, as opposed to, you know, a homeowner issue and helping homeowners focus on what they can do to protect themselves, until we do that, homeowners are not going to be adequately protected or informed.
So this is fascinating because I think that there are a lot of misconceptions about fire. I think that we have, like you said, a hubris and also an emotional connection to them. You know, there's this idea that somehow man invented fire. No, no, we did not invent it. We figured out how to use it. We did not invent it. But a lot of these misconceptions are being used kind of against the science, to legislate against the science. So coming back to this issue that you are actively fighting along with some colleagues right now, what is the rhetoric that we're hearing? What are the Republican lawmakers and the industry lobbyists saying is a good reason to basically deregulate the forests?
Right. Okay, I'm just going to go through a few of the top myths, because there are many of them. One of them is fire destroys the forest. That's not true. We know that ecologically it's not true. A related one is that, okay, maybe fire is okay, but only if it burns at low intensity. If it sort of creeps along and consumes pine needles and maybe some small trees, but doesn't ever get into the crown of the forest and kill the larger trees, that's bad. Well, we know that's not true. In fact, that creates some of the best habitat, those high-intensity fire patches.
So you want those big trees to go up
absolutely.
In these kinds of fires.
Absolutely. You want that. You want patches of that. You want the mix. And so long as we have it in its kind of healthy level, you don't want too much or too little fire, low, moderate, or high intensity. Right now, again, the problem is we have far too little of all intensities. And then a large portion of the stuff that burns at high intensity that creates that great snag forest habitat, a lot of that's clear cut by the Forest Service. So it's a real conservation problem. So that's another one. Another one is, we suppressed fires for so long. This one's one of my personal favorites. We suppressed fires for so long that the forests are now overstocked. They're overly dense. And therefore, we can't let fires burn because when they burn, they'll burn too hot and that really will destroy the forest. And therefore, we need to go in and log them and continue suppressing them.
So yeah, it's sort of. That, first of all, that's insane. But second of all, this is all linked to this idea that they're trying to say deregulate. So all of these things, fire is bad, or wait, fire is good, but this kind of fire is bad, or wait, fire is okay, but they can't burn the right way they're supposed to because there's too many trees. All of this is like, so let me cut them down, right?
The solution always comes at the end of a chainsaw.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, there's a lot of opportunism involved in this. And I think, as you mentioned earlier, you know, some people have been misled by this rhetoric, and they're well-meaning. Mm-hmm. And they articulate this, and some people are very cynically using this opportunistically. So there is a mix. Not everyone's doing this, you know, in a cynical way. But I think there's definitely a public education challenge that we need to engage here. So that's definitely one. And what we found is that it turns out that the most long unburned forests, the ones that have not burned in the longest period of time, they actually, again, burn mostly at low and moderate intensity when they burn. They have significant patches of high intensity like the other fires do, but they don't have more. In fact, sometimes they have less. Again, seems counterintuitive. You would think, well, fuels continue to accumulate, and therefore they'll burn hotter. And that was the assumption for so long. In fact, it made so much sense to so many people that they didn't even bother to test it scientifically. We were some of the first people to go in there and actually test it and publish studies on it and find out, well, actually, it's not true at all. But it made so much sense to people.
It's a logical fallacy. We have it all the time. It's
exactly.
This idea that, like, you're due for something to happen because it hasn't happened in so long.
Right. Right. And so that was the thinking. So if we let these fires burn, if we don't suppress them, if, you know, and if we don't go in there and log all the forests and try to, you know, reduce the fuel, which is, you know, that's the kind of terminology that's being used. then when they burn, they'll burn almost exclusively at high intensity. It's not at all happening. In fact, if anything, the largest fires are burning even at higher levels of low and moderate and lower levels of high intensity, burning less intensely, if anything. There are exceptions to that. But even the ones that have somewhat higher levels of high intensity still are mostly low and moderate.
Mm-hmm.
So then again, that's just a myth. And another one is that we can suppress fire. When it's very low fire weather, and if the fire's small, and if it's creeping along, those are the fires that get suppressed, and almost all of those get suppressed. So there's definitely truth to that, but it's not true when it applies to fires that get to a certain size and then are driven by weather, which pretty much all large fires are.
It's kind of like thinking about a house that's up in flames. Like, it's easy to stop, not easy, but if you can stop a fire at its source, maybe it just damages part of the kitchen. Maybe it just damages part of the bathroom,
right,
wherever it started. But by the time the whole house is in flames, yeah, you can put the fire out eventually, but the house still burned down.
Exactly. And it's actually, I mean, it's kind of good to think about the house versus the forest and think about them as separate conversations, because I think part of it is people think about fire in a destructive way in so many ways because they think about the house down the street that burned or their house that burned.
Because that's
right,
their only relationship with fire that's
exactly
not controlled. You know, when we think
right
of controlled fire, we think of cooking, we think of warmth. But
right,
any once we lose control, and even those cooking fires and those warmth fires can turn ugly, you know, if we don't do what we need to do to keep them safe, if we don't clean the flue, if we have a fuel leak or something like that. And yes, we think of fire as being a punishing force of nature because that is our relationship as human beings with it.
Exactly. And when fire burns a house, it is destroyed and it is a tragedy. But we then take that concept and we apply it to the forest ecosystems and we assume that the same thing must be true, but in fact, it's exactly the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the thing, we just kind of need to retrain our thinking about this. But so that's another one. And then, one of the biggest ones is that if we just, and this is one of the ones that's driving the current legislation that's being proposed by the Republicans and some Democrats, if we just suspend the federal environmental laws and remove all those pesky environmental protections, and we just get in there and let the timber industry just even more aggressively log our forests on public lands, that somehow then, because we will be removing all this fuel from the forest, that will reduce fire intensity and save the forest from fire. And this is, again, the one that it makes intuitive sense to a lot of people. It turns out exactly the opposite is true, exactly the opposite. That the most protected forests, the ones with the most protections under the environmental laws and the least amount of logging or no logging historically, when they burn, even when you control for forest type and topography and all these other things, when they burn at lower intensity. They still have a mix. All fires have a mix of low, moderate, and high intensity in our forests in the West. They naturally have that mix. They're supposed to have that mix.
But when you look at them in like the statistical aggregate, you actually find that logged forest and forests that have been thinned out actually burn in a
yes
more intense way.
That's exactly right. And if anything is kind of closer to being kind of uncharacteristically severe or intense, it's how fire burns in forests that have the most logging history and the least environmental protections. So if you look at any of these large fires and you look at what happens on, because typically they'll burn in a mix of national forest lands, national park lands, and private industrial timberlands.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, the Rim Fire of 2013,
mm-hmm,
it burned on a mix of those three, and there's very, very different land management and protection regimes. Well, the fire burned the hottest on the private industrial timberlands that have been heavily logged for many decades. It burned the next hottest on the national forest lands that have kind of some protections, but also a lot of logging,
mm-hmm,
that goes on, commercial logging. A lot of people don't realize that there's a logging program on our national forest lands.
Yeah.
And then the least occurred on the national park lands, which don't have a logging history and are completely protected from logging, and on the small portion of the national forest lands that had protections, like roadless areas. And
so you
and we
could almost
that
map that correlation.
Oh, yeah, and we have, actually. And you see that in other large fires, the Biscuit Fire of 2002 in southwestern Oregon.
There was a fire in 2002 called the Biscuit Fire?
The Biscuit Fire, yeah.
Why is it
fire
called the Biscuit Fire?
I have no idea. Usually, and this is
very
one of these
catchy name for that fire.
Yeah, a lot of fires have these sort of smart alecky names. how fires get named is one of these internal Forest Service things. And so you'll see these sort of tongue-in-cheek names oftentimes. Sometimes it's just, it started by a ridge that was called Biscuit Ridge for some reason that no one knows. And, you know, it's been that way since 1870. And, you know,
I like to think that there's like a nice little story behind every single one, you know, some Forest Service worker on a bet or, you know, some sort of nickname that somebody had. And then they got to name them. It's your turn, Mike. What you got?
Sometimes there are. Sometimes there are stories, but oftentimes it's just a mystery how they get named. So I should mention one other myth, and this is a big one, that when fires burn hot in those patches of high intensity that comprise typically 15, 20, 25% of a given large fire, those high intensity fire patches where most or all the trees are killed. One of the most persistent myths is that fire will basically prevent the forest from regenerating.
Huh.
Because too many trees were killed and because there's not a seed source
of any live trees. Oh, like it's too much of a wasteland now.
Yeah, that's exactly. You'll hear this terminology, a wasteland or a moonscape, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And the idea is that the assumption was for many years that there aren't enough live trees to provide a seed source from the cones to regenerate the forest. Again, it made intuitive sense to so many people for so many years. No one bothered to really check it that carefully. And it turns out, again, it's just completely wrong. The forests naturally regenerate. I'm doing a lot of this research right now. I'm doing the biggest study that's ever been done on this, to my knowledge. And I'm going doing transects deep into the largest high-intensity fire patches in places like the Rim Fire, where I'm 1,000 meters into the interior of a high-intensity fire patch, and I'm seeing 200, 300, 400 naturally regenerating conifer seedlings break or pines that are already knee-high just 2 years after the fire. Oaks, you know, my study's focused on the conifers, but the oaks, some of them are already 6 feet tall. They're over the top of my head.
And from a fire from how long ago?
Just 2 years.
Yeah, that's crazy. I would think, though, that you could learn a lot about the ability for the forest to regenerate by studying the seeds of these different organisms, right? That they have some sort of intrinsic or evolved fire protection because the forests are supposed to burn.
Exactly. And you can definitely do that for certain species in particular. There are some species of conifers that are called serotonous trees. They have cones that have these very thick resins. And they've evolved. So basically, they depend upon not just fire, but high-intensity fire to burn hot enough and the flames to get high enough to melt those resins. And then it causes the cones to release the seeds.
Oh, cool. So it's not just about being protected by the fire or being protected in order to withstand the fire. The fire actually activates its propagation.
Exactly. And giant sequoias are one of those species, but there are also a number of other ones, Rocky Mountain Lodgepole Pine, and we have some other ones in California here, Coulter Pine, Knobcone Pine. And then there are other ones that are not serotonous. And people thought, well, you know, maybe they shouldn't have high-intensity fire in those forests, Ponderosa Pine, Jeffrey Pine, for example. Well, it turns out that there are just other mechanisms, you know, call it other evolutionary strategies.
Sure.
Serotony is just one way to get at it, but other ones have other means. And the other thing that people forget about is the birds and the small mammals. They are seed dispersers, and they disperse seeds all over the place. So, you know, where we live, we see these flocks of pinion jays flying around all the time. Well, pinion jays are seed cachers. They take the pine seeds and they plant them all over the place so they have food for the winter. The one pinion jay can basically cache like 3,000 seeds.
Wow.
And they have a spatial memory that rivals the smartest humans. I mean, I don't know of anyone who could do what a pinion jay does on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm.
Find the exact location of thousands of seeds every year. And of course, they forget a certain amount. They're not perfect. And sometimes they die of old age or they get preyed upon and then those seeds germinate. So they're basically replanting the forest all over the place, and they play this important role. People forget about the birds, and they forget about the small mammals. And so there's a lot of mechanisms in forests. They're very complex systems.
Mm.
It's not just how far the wind can blow the seeds from the nearest live tree edge into these high-intensity fire patches. It's also about surviving seeds. It's about small mammals and birds dispersing seeds. It's about a lot of things. And it's about how the fact that you know, there are surviving trees even in the interior of these largest high-intensity fire patches.
They don't just plow everything down.
Exactly. The fire kills the trees, but it doesn't kill all the trees, even in the areas where it burns hottest, which, like I said, is only like 15 or 20% of the total usually. even in that, it might be 75 to 100% mortality, but it's not 100% everywhere.
Yeah, that's interesting. And so then you have these little kind of fledgling, maybe small trees or plants that are already have a foothold, and then they can sort of proliferate from there.
Well, it actually comes from the big ones that survive.
So you'll see like a sequoia, even in a region that's high intensity, you'll see it.
Especially sequoias. But I'm talking about, ponderosa pine, incense cedar, white fir, things like that. The big ones are the ones that tend to survive even the hottest fires because they are the tallest. They have the thickest, most fire-resistant bark. The crowns are the tallest above the flames. And so, they oftentimes survive even when most of the trees around them are killed. Giant sequoias are probably the most fire-resistant conifer species on the planet. They have incredibly thick fire-resistant bark. They're so tall that even if you've got a crown fire in the rest of the forest, the flames can't reach the upper crown of some of the big ones.
And I wonder if that's another contributor to why, as human beings, we're sentimental. And we think about these big, beautiful old trees, and we almost put human characteristics on them. We think of them as being wise and as being, keepers of the forest and watchers over us. And the idea that they could burn down is such a tragedy to us. It's so unfair that somehow it is our duty as protectors to prevent nature from being mean to these big trees.
I think that's a good observation. And I think that the giant sequoia forest ecosystem is one of the places that has the most to teach us about how we should be looking at forests. And, these are not domesticated landscapes. These are wild, dynamic landscapes, and they should be. They have to be in order for biodiversity to survive. And it's not just, the blackback woodpeckers and these other species that need the snag forest habitat for various reasons. It's also species like the giant sequoia. In a way, we're loving the giant sequoia to death, because we've been trying so carefully to suppress fire, especially moderate or high-intensity fire, from these giant sequoia groves. Well, it turns out that every study that's looked at this has found that the only way you get really decent regeneration of the forest is if you get moderate or high-intensity fire. Because like I said, the cones are serotonous. In addition, they can't germinate unless you basically get fire that burns hot enough to consume most of that what we call duff and litter on the forest floor. It's really thick. You kind of need to turn that into a mineral ash bed and for the cones to actually, for the seeds to be able to germinate effectively. And so that means you need fire that burns fairly intensely. And that's going to kill some trees. It's going to kill even some of the sequoias. Most are not going to die, but you will kill some. That's okay.
And you can't be precious about it.
No, you can't be precious about it. That's exactly right. You need to understand this is a dynamic forest ecosystem, and that giant sequoia snag is going to stand there for decades and decades and provide homes for countless wildlife species. One of those big giant sequoia snags, it's almost like an ecosystem unto itself. If you hike out there and you look at those things that have been standing there for decades, you can't even count the number of nest cavities that it's got. They're incredible.
Just on that one tree.
Just on the one tree.
I think it's interesting that you mentioned, because you are an ecologist, you are an activist. So you, in many ways, are the embodiment of an environmental list, an environmental movement, however you want to define it. But I love that you literally just use the phrase, we're loving them to death. We think about these terms, these kind of, derogative terms that we throw around, like tree hugger and bunny hugger. That's one of my friends who's a science writer and writes a lot of ecology. He's always talking about bunny huggers. And I do think it's funny that people who actually work in these fields oftentimes have an eye roll associated with quote unquote tree hugging, because the activists who in many cases think that they're doing the right thing by trying to protect these ecosystems are actually in many ways harming them the most.
Yeah, I think that's very well put. I think that we still see a lot of that. When we understood a lot less about fire ecology in forest ecosystems in particular, I think there was this idea that what we need to do is protect these live big pine trees and big fir trees and that nothing else matters. So as long as we protect these really big old trees, that everything will be okay. And I think that, after a while, it became sort of like treating these forest ecosystems like a museum. Mm-hmm. And they're not a museum. They're a living system, and they have to have these dynamic processes like fire, like drought and pulses of native beetle mortality, they have to have that happen to keep the system ecologically healthy. Otherwise, you literally risk losing entire groups of species from the system if you try to control it too much.
Yeah, I think it's interesting sometimes when you do step back and see, no pun intended, the forest for the trees, that there are individuals fighting on both sides of the aisle that ultimately in many ways are unknowingly allied, that there are, you know, there's industry and there are Republican politicians and lobbyists who are fighting to cut down these trees. And in many ways, ultimately, that's for the same, not for the same outcome, but can have the same effect as the individuals who are desperately trying to keep the trees from being touched by fire. Both of those things are actually detrimental to the health of the forest.
Exactly. And caught in the middle are species like the blackback woodpecker, which is probably the classic indicator species for snag forest habitat. Mm-hmm. So just to give you an example, you know, one pair of blackback woodpeckers needs about 200 acres of mature, dense forest that burns at high intensity, where most or all the trees are killed, just to have enough food to survive. And so, you know, unless we are more open in our thinking about forest ecosystems, and unless, frankly, we get the money out of the system, you know, the timber sales program on our national forests and other federal public lands is just as corrupting an influence as is campaign contributions for politicians in Congress.
Sure.
And until we get the money out of the system, we're going to continue to hear very misleading rhetoric that is going to be used to justify the same old damaging logging practices that we saw in the past.
It makes me wonder what we can do as consumers. I mean, you know, I'm working on construction in a home right now. It's not a new home, but we are actually fixing it up. And you have to replace beams and you have to replace posts. And wood is necessary to a lot of people's lives. It makes me wonder if, you know, is it advantageous to look for reclaimed wood? Is it advantageous to, are there multiple density fiber, like are there certain options that are more ecologically sound?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think that's one of the places the conversation needs to go. Mm-hmm. You know, no one's expecting that we stop using all wood overnight, but I think we can do better. And I think we can definitely use less. And I think we have to use less.
And we can make choices. Like we can, you know, empower ourselves to look at the species that we're buying or to look at where it's imported from. Is it a place where there's, you know, more healthy, I don't even know if there's such a thing, but healthier logging happening? Is it a place where it's, you know, unprotected forest and it's actually causing a lot of negative impact to the land and also to the community surrounding it?
Yeah. And I think a lot of lumber goes into landfills that could be reused. There's no question. There's a tremendous amount of that. That could be reclaimed and used. We also can start using more of, light gauge steel for mm-hmm. housing framing. It's a very viable option. Mostly it's recycled. And the reason that light gauge steel does not have a larger market share is mostly because taxpayers are subsidizing logging on national forests and other logging every single year, unwittingly, unknowingly. And that's basically artificially tipping the scales in the market in favor of lumber consumption.
So I see. It's like the reason that everything we eat is made of corn.
Yeah.
It's a very similar situation.
Kind of like that, yeah. So a lot of this would sort of get taken care of itself if we stopped, you know, artificially tipping the balance in favor of logging and lumber production. And, you know, one of the things that I think that would be most important to do there, where we have some of the last best habitat and most intact forest habitat, is on our federal public lands, national forests and other federal public lands. For me, that's the priority. That's the place that we really need to protect those lands. And unfortunately, right now, under current laws, most of those forests are not protected, and the Forest Service is actively selling that public timber to private logging companies. They're going in and, you know, intensively logging those areas, oftentimes clear-cutting them at enormous cost to taxpayer and enormous biodiversity costs. So to me, those forests should be protected. That should be our top priority.
And costs to our health in many ways. You know, this actively contributes to climate change, clearing down forests. These are things that, it's funny because this whole this whole discussion is in many ways very complicatedly linked to climate change, you know, especially the conversation about, is forest fire good? Is it bad? Should there be more? Should there be less? What's normal? How has it changed? Well, we're in drought right now. So can a forest fire that starts stop the way it would naturally, since there's not enough water in the ravines around it, since the soil itself is drier? these are all incredibly complicated questions, but one thing that we do know is that it's only going to get worse as long as we keep making decisions that increase the amount of carbon in the atmosphere, that decrease the naturally occurring carbon sinks, like forests, that exist. They're very good for maintaining homeostasis, which we're really lacking right now. I have a question for you that I think is, it's been on my mind through most of this conversation, and it's complicated, or maybe it's not, but are you in favor of controlled burning?
Yes and no. It depends where it is. Controlled burning can be an important thing to basically modify future fire behavior and potential. It can do that effectively for about a decade after you do the controlled burn. After that, then the forest kind of comes back to where it was before you did the burn.
So it's kind of like the ICU for forests that have really been neglected.
Well, and it's not that. I would say it's really about protecting communities.
Oh, interesting.
You
know,
you don't want to do it right next to homes necessarily, but you can do it fairly close by. And there's a role for that. So there are places where you can do this. The problem with controlled burning is that it can never be a proxy for wildland fire and the ecological role of wildland fire.
Okay.
For the simple reason that controlled burns are done in the spring or in the fall when the fire weather is necessarily very low. There's a lot of moisture in the system and you don't get those hot, dry, windy days. And so the whole goal is to make sure that you get fire that burns homogeneously at low intensity. And so you're not going to get blackback woodpecker habitat. Mm-hmm. You're not going to get foraging habitat for spotted owls, those areas that burn hotter and have that great small mammal prey base. You're not going to get habitat for all those shrub nesting species that depend upon all those flowering shrubs that come in only after high intensity fire, typically. And so it actually can cause a lot of damage in a sense, because what it's doing is it's taking off the table that portion of the landscape from being even having the potential to have that kind of habitat created when a wildland fire occurs next. That's not to say there's never a place for prescribed fire. I wouldn't say that at all. I would say that where you're going to do it, it really should be focused more on creating a mix of fire intensities and create that as a desired condition. You know, in the past, when Forest Service land managers would set a prescribed fire, if it ends up burning a little bit hotter in places, then somebody might lose their job. They certainly get a stern talking to. We need to change that. That needs to be a pat on the back. Hey, great. You've got some heterogeneity in there. You know, you've got some natural mix of fire intensities. That's going to benefit different species and different groups of species.
So it's a massive paradigm shift, which is very hard for people to undertake. It sounds very radical when you've been set in your ways for so long.
There's no question it's a shift, and it's going to be a difficult thing for some people, but I think we have to go there. But the bigger thing, I think, is being more accepting of lightning-caused fires and not trying to fight those in those more remote forests. When they're by towns, that's different. That's about protecting public health and safety, and that's where we need to focus. But if it's that lightning-caused fire off, in that backcountry area over the ridge, we need to let those fires burn and not try to stop them and get in there and try to suppress them. And that we call managed wildland fire, or wildland fire use. And that's what we need to do more of. And I think that's where the focus needs to be, because then you're going to get your natural mix of habitat types from that fire that you really can only get with lightning caused, with natural fires that happen in the summer.
So it reminds me, this is such a random analogy I'm going to. I sometimes try to make analogies when it comes to science communication. Sometimes it works, sometimes it don't. The ICU one apparently didn't work, but that's okay. But it does remind me of one time when I used to work as I managed a cell culture facility and was the chief cell culture technician. And so weekly we would have a pregnant mouse, and it was my job, my very difficult job, to sacrifice her, to dissect out her pups, to dissect brain tissue out of her pups, and do a lot of different processes to get these individual cells isolated and then get them growing into new neuronal networks on plates that we could then record electrical activity from. Ugh, that's a mouthful. And oftentimes, this was just the go through the motions, do it the same every week. A handful of times we would get our exactly perfectly timed pregnant mice from the company that we ordered them from, and oops, she would give birth early. And now I can't use these because they are already born and I needed prenatal pups. So the idea was you give them back to the animal manager and probably he would euthanize them. I was not comfortable with this. And so on more than one occasion, I had mice pets that gave birth a little too early. And so I had a, you know, a fun little cage at home, and it had an observation deck in the top. It was like a converted hamster cage. And I remember one time very specifically, Mama Mouse and all of her pups, and I'm watching her nurse her pups, and I'm feeding her to make sure she's really healthy. And she chose, these four pups get fed. These five pups are going to die. And I had a real problem with this, a real emotional and psychological problem. And I remember watching these pups getting skinnier and skinnier and crying out for their mother, who was on one level, and she was just ignoring. And I remember thinking, oh, well, I'm going to trick her. And I would take them and swap them. And she knew. She knew when I would put the wrong pup close to her, she would immediately take it and put it again out in exile and not feed it. And this is a very natural process. It's something that I was trying to intervene with because I was being sentimental. But the truth of the matter is, she only had enough resources for so many pups, and she had to choose which ones she thought were most viable and make that decision. No matter what I did, I couldn't influence her decision. I think that was a big life lesson for me, and it's something that I have been able to apply as I try my best as somebody without an ecology background to understand the natural world around me. I'm interested to show you. I know that this is a podcast and nobody else can see, but I urge you to Google. There's a beautiful comic by an artist, I think, named Corey Bradshaw. Let me make sure that that's correct. It's tiny. Copyright? No, it's not by Corey Bradshaw. Sorry, I'm going to pick that up again. There is a beautiful comic called The Fence. And it's very hard to read the copyright at the bottom of it. Ooh, I think I might be able to on this one. Darnell Green. I'm going to look that up and I'm going to dub it in later. But copyright 2002. And it's called The Fence. And in the first picture, it says 8000 BC, and it's all green, and there's a little tiny fence. It looks like a crown on the planet. We call it a fence. It keeps out the giraffes and the lions and the elephants and the... And then in the next one, it's covering about half the planet. It's green on one side, it's brown on the other, AD 1500. Then we get to 1800, and now the grassy part is much smaller and the brown part is much larger. And then finally, we call it a wildlife preserve. It keeps in the giraffes and the lions and the elephants. And this really, I think, in many ways shows the evolution that agriculture and that an explosive human population has had. Now, making moral judgments about people having sidewalks and roads, and I'm not sure if that's even relevant to the conversation because it is what it is, but this is a bigger question that I'm interested in opening with you, and I know you're not going to have all the answers, and I know we're not even going to have the time to ponder this psychologically, but it's a question I often talk about with my friends who work in ecology. How much can we control things? How much can we set things back the way they were? How much should we try to rescue certain organisms? How much should we try to live harmoniously with them? And I think it's an internal struggle for a lot of people. I know some ecologists that are very pro-zoo, and I know some that are very anti-zoo. Zoos historically were more like circuses. They were more like freak shows. Now they have a lot of more conservation programs going into them. We now know that there are organisms that only exist in zoos that we can't find in the wild. How important is it that we maintain their lineage, knowing that they'll never again have a place outside of their enclosure? I mean, big questions that I'm always interested to hear an ecologist's perspective. Of course, like I said, I know I just threw a lot at you, but...
No, those are very important questions, and I think it goes to, you know, deeper philosophical underpinnings about ecology and our relationship with nature. You know, I definitely am very supportive of zoos in the sense that in certain circumstances they're basically places where the last individuals of certain animal species are that potentially could be, you know, repopulated, you know, mm-hmm. basically reintroduced into the wild at some point in time. Having said that, I think that the priority always needs to be on habitat protection. You know, we don't want to get into a circumstance where we think, oh, well, you know, maybe that last bit of habitat, it's going to be developed, it's going to be cut down or paved over, but we've got these zoos that have got these individuals, and maybe we'll figure it out later.
Yeah, because in many ways, I shouldn't say what good is a species. It's got intrinsic value, but how helpful is it if it doesn't have anywhere to live? We talked about this a lot with de-extinction. Should we bring back the woolly mammoth? Well, where would it live? he's, you know, the woolly mammoth is extinct. He, she, I don't know. So is its habitat. So is its ecology. And so in many ways, these are questions that I think we often wrestle with, because it's not an animal alone that goes extinct. Oftentimes the animal goes extinct because its habitat went extinct around it.
Yeah, for me, I this definitely, you're right. This is a larger conversation, and it's a very interesting one, an important one. But I'd say one broad principle from my perspective as an ecologist is that you can't, if your goal is to maintain and protect more biodiversity and recover species who have become imperiled because of habitat loss and fragmentation, you cannot protect too much habitat.
Interesting.
Habitat protection begets biodiversity conservation. It is just a very, very solid principle. We have so many different studies that indicate that. You know, you look at the California spotted owl, the places that that species is declining the worst, that's the places with the least protections and the most logging. And the places where the populations are, you know, pretty stable or close to stable, the very few where it's close to stable are the places that are protected. And they've got an active fire regime.
Yeah.
You know, so this is not a hands-off system. This is an active dynamic system, these natural processes that are occurring, but they're not being managed by man in the way that the rest of the forested landscape is. Now, unfortunately, there's too little of that in the landscape to conserve the population. So what that means is we need more protected forests.
Yeah.
So, I mean, part of this goes back to the hubris comment, you know, we were talking about earlier, that we think, well, you know, we always have to do something. If there's a problem, it always requires an active solution.
Yeah, and well, that somehow we are the arbiters
we,
of that.
Exactly. We, it's all down to us, and we're going to get in there and roll up our sleeves and get busy, and we're going to save a bunch of species by doing something active. And unfortunately, what that often means is, when politics and economics get involved, is logging and road building and a lot of other development. And then the species keep declining, and everyone scratches their head and says, well, I wonder why that's happening. Well, you know, it's no surprise. When we see protected landscapes, and that doesn't mean that that protection doesn't mean stasis. Protection means dynamic processes. It means dynamic processes are allowed to occur unimpeded. It means that when you have a fire and you have a high-intensity fire patch, you allow the forest to naturally regenerate. You allow that natural succession to occur, because all those natural successional stages provide habitat for distinct groups of wildlife species that really can't survive effectively elsewhere. And so I think that, you know, we need sort of a benevolent neglect approach.
I like that. I think that's a cool, you should coin that, by the way. I think that's a great way to think about it too, because you know what, we do want to always be active, especially people who are activists, people who want to make an impact and make a difference. And I think that what we sometimes do is we lose the forest for the trees, because there are things that we can do in our own backyards that can have a really big impact. And then there are other ways that we can have an impact just by educating ourselves and knowing that sometimes it is better to just walk away. You know, if you live in Los Angeles, which only a fraction of my listeners do, but many of you might live in even more rural areas than LA. I mean, I am planning in the new house to ensure that all of the landscaping around the house is low water, drought resistant, natural indigenous plants that will welcome, because I think about where I'm going to be living. That's habitat on a ridge. You know, in Los Feliz, like by the Griffith Observatory, overlooking, that's where animals live. There are, we see coyotes on the street. We see organisms. We see these hawks flying around. I don't want to make them think my house means stay away. I want to make them think my house means come, drink, eat, pollinate, all of those good things. I want to have wildlife in my backyard. And I know that that's an option for a lot of people. And it's just about making those kinds of choices.
I think that's exactly right. And there are small things that we can do, even in an urban and suburban environment, to welcome nature into that environment and make it more natural and make it more native and allow that to be habitat. It's not just a binary thing that we have the human environment and then somewhere there's a clear line of demarcation and then it's the natural environment and you know, never the two will meet.
But we have treated it like that for so long.
We have. And I think, you know, that benevolent neglect concept I was talking about a moment ago, in order to achieve that, ironically, it's going to require a very, very active effort to change the laws to get protections for those forest lands so that we can let natural processes occur. Because right now, under current laws, those national forests are being logged. They're being clear-cut at taxpayer expense. And, you know, a lot of those areas after fire that are where the forests are naturally regenerating at no cost to taxpayers, hundreds of these beautiful pine and fir seedlings per acre, when they go in there and log that, they roll over those with the heavy logging equipment and actually kill all of those conifer seedlings and saplings. Almost all of that is killed. And then taxpayers are forced to foot the bill to the tune of about $1 million for every 1,000 acres to artificially plant those areas because the natural regeneration capacity was destroyed by the logging. And it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. So I think, you know, in order to get to that place where we can say, this is a wild landscape, this is a protected landscape where we're going to let wild nature occur and not try to impede it or control it, you know, we're going to have to fight for that. As a society, we're going to have to fight for that. Otherwise, and if we don't, we're going to lose species because there's a lot of them that are in trouble. But I want to make sure I convey that I am an optimist in this. I think we will accomplish that. Mm-hmm. And I think we will recover those populations before they get too bad for most of them. But it definitely is going to take an effort.
Yeah, guys, you hear me say it all the time on the show, evidence-based legislation. I would love to see us moving more towards that model in this country. And the only way that we can do it is through civic engagement. This is why it is so important that we vote. This is why it is so important that we write letters to our congresspeople and that we let them know what we think, because they are beholden. Yes, they're beholden to the lobbyists. And yes, we can roll our eyes about how much money there is in the system. But ultimately, they can't even do what the lobbyists do if their own constituency is turning against them, because they want to get reelected. And they can't get reelected unless you like them. So you tell them what you want and they are there to represent you. I know it sounds naive, but it actually does work that way in a large scale. And before we go, because we have run a little over and I have kept you on air a little longer than I had promised I would, Chad, but I end every podcast asking my guests the same two questions, which you probably don't know. So I'm springing this on you, which is fun. And they're big picture questions, so I apologize in advance. But I have guests on from every walk of life who study different kinds of sciences and sometimes aren't even in the sciences. And I'm really interested to see their perspective on this. The first question is the bummer question, which is why I start with that, which is, when you look to the future, what is the thing that most keeps you up at night? What is, you know, concerning you the most? And then on the flip side of that, so that we can end on a more positive note, what are you most optimistic and hopeful about? I know, they're tough.
Good
questions. It's so mean, though. It's so mean.
Right at the end, too. Wow. Okay, so I'm most concerned about two things, really. Direct habitat destruction and loss, and obviously the impacts of human-caused climate change. And one of the things that concerns me is a lot of the things that are being done, in some cases, just by people who mean well but are poorly informed, in some cases cynically, that are exacerbating the adverse impacts of climate change to biodiversity and to systems, things that are being done in the name of climate mitigation. And we see this in forest issues, you know, in forest management. You know, so much of the logging that's happening out there is being done under the guise of mitigating climate change. You know, somehow we need to log the forest to prevent them from burning, which, you know, it doesn't work that way anyway. But like you said earlier, you're removing these enormous amounts of carbon from the system. And, you know, in reality, you know, these post-fire forests actually store huge amounts of carbon. Some of the highest levels of carbon storage you'll find are in post-fire habitat, including these snag forest patches, because very little is consumed, and then the forest starts naturally regenerating and sequestering enormous amounts of carbon. So I see things like that, and I just worry there's so much fear and misunderstanding with regard to climate change and with regard to fire in particular, and the linkage between those two things, that I see partly because of just fear and people not thinking rationally when they're afraid, and partly because of political and economic opportunism. I see a lot of damaging things happening out there in the name of climate mitigation, when what we really need to be focusing on is more habitat protection to store more carbon in those forests and basically curbing our fossil fuel consumption.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a complicated thing, right, fundamentally. And so that's a big concern, obviously. My big hope, mm-hmm. or the thing that makes me optimistic, you know, you mentioned, you know, lobbyists with their enormous amounts of cash. You know, there's no question there's so much money in the system. But I'll tell you what, one thing I've learned is that I don't care how many lobbyists you line up with, you know, enormous amounts of cash to contribute. They are no match for a scrappy constituency if they're passionate about something.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've seen time and time again the ability of even relatively small groups of citizens who care passionately about something and are willing to really put their shoulder to it. I've seen their ability to affect change. And I do believe that we can do that. But that's what it's going to take. It's going to take grassroots action. It really is. And I don't think anyone's on the sidelines anymore, you know, and including scientists.
Yeah.
You know, scientists love talking to each other,
mm-hmm.
But they typically are not very comfortable talking to the public or to policymakers or land managers. And we need to change that.
Yep.
You know, we all have to get involved in this because we have a major challenge ahead.
Yeah, I agree. That is why I do the show. I think it's really important to be able to have a bridge there between the scientists and the public and ensure that we are as informed as we can be. And sometimes it's hard to read the journal articles and it's hard to watch the wonky symposia. But if you can have a conversation and you can try and understand it just at a very basic level, it can mean a lot. So I'm really hoping that a lot of people who are listening today were pleasantly informed by some of the conversations that we had. And before we bid adieu, I have to ask, how can people read about the work that you're doing or, you know, find out what's going on?
Well, please go to our website, www.johnmuirproject.org. And there's all kinds of information on there that you can read, and you can also get involved and give us your contact information. There's links in there where you can give us, you know, get on our mailing list and, you know, kind of become an activist and get involved if you like. And you can email us and contact us if you have follow-up questions and want to learn more. But yeah, definitely check out our website, John Muir Project.
I'm there right now. It's beautiful. And look, there is the black-backed woodpecker. Learning things already. All right, guys. Thank you so much for tuning in this week. And thank you for coming back week after week. I am so excited to continue to have these great conversations with our wonderful guests and also with you. And I'm looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.